Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. We have another special guest this week in Damien Bowie, who is Credit Suisse's Head of Australian Economics and Equity Strategy. He has worked for the firm for 13 years, and prior to his career at Credit Suisse, he worked for 4 years at the Reserve Bank of Australia. Damien specialises in global asset allocation, style rotation, foreign exchange, and alternative schools of economic thought. He applies these disciplines to the Australian equity market to give investors unique, forward-looking, and global insights into portfolio construction. He has consistently rated top three across surveys and panels for Credit Suisse's priority clients. In today's interview, we find out more about the depth and coverage of analysis that drives investment in one of the world's major investment houses. Damien sits in the perfect position to provide some serious insight into global investment and the state of the Australian property market. After the interview, we'll then look at some of the wider investment implications that these themes can impact on how we invest money every day at Nucleus Wealth. I hope you enjoy. So today on the podcast, we're happy to have Credit Suisse's current Head of Australian Economics and Equity Strategy, Damien Bowie. Welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I might just start off by, for our listening audience, would you mind providing just a bit of background on yourself and what you've been working on?
Sure. So my background is I started for about 3-4 years working with the RBA, the central bank, moved over to Credit Suisse, and my role was basically to try to take a lot of the macro modelling that I'd done at the RBA and apply them to some of the quant black boxes that the street is using for trading equities. So I've been doing this job now for about 14 years, and my approach to things is very much starting from the biggest picture and distilling that towards the smallest picture. So whereas most of the street will have the view that policy will drive economy, which drives markets, I pretty much take the opposite view, that market will drive economy, which will drive policy. So in terms of some interesting things that are worthwhile thinking about at the moment and stuff that I'm looking at, obviously what's happening with Australia, with our credit conditions, housing market, but more generally, I think I'm very interested in what's happening in asset allocation land, in particular the interaction between what's happening in the multi-asset space and factor investing. I think that that's fascinating, and what's happened at the beginning of the year really highlights how fascinating that space actually is.
Absolutely.
So do you want to, do you want to elaborate? I guess that's probably a good segue to jump into some more on asset allocation. So, you know, in terms of the style rotation at the moment, certainly we've been looking at the you know, a lot of the underperformance of momentum, and certainly sporadic performance of momentum, and yeah, there's been a lot in terms of, and what I mean by momentum for any viewers is, listeners, is just that the you generally tend to buy stocks that go up, keep going up, or stocks that go down, keep going down, and that's generally been a profitable strategy, but with big reversals. Over the last year or two, that's been quite a poor strategy. And then the other one is obviously the underperformance of value, and sort of question marks about whether there's, that's got, whether there's other issues and changes in accounting standards which are affecting that. So I guess, what are your thoughts on, the momentum first?
Yeah. The issue with momentum is, or there are two things. When does it actually work globally? And then the second issue is, is there a one-size-fits-all solution there? So if it's working well in the US, is there any guarantee that the same style or factor will work out in any other country? So the first question on when does momentum actually work as a strategy, it works when the positioning, historical positioning of investors is more or less aligned with what the forward-looking growth signals are suggesting. So if you are able to understand the performance of cyclicals versus defensives over the last 12 months, if you're able to construct a forward-looking indicator of growth like the yield curve, if they're kind of giving you directionally the same sort of signals, that's the time that momentum works. So if we've been positioning pro-cyclically over defensives and the yield curve has been upward sloping, consistent with growth and potential rate hikes, then you can persist with that strategy. Whereas on the other hand, if you're positioning pro-cyclically and the yield curve is inverted, consistent with a slowdown and rate cuts, actually you'll be caught completely off guard by that because defensives will outperform, but momentum will be putting you in the more cyclical end of town. And, you know, you can iterate that for when, you know, the curve is inverted and positioning is defensive, et cetera, et cetera. So what you found at the beginning of the year was that momentum actually did quite poorly because it was picking defensive stocks. The yield curve in America, properly measured, became quite inverted, but yet the U.S. equity market had a very, very strong rally. So momentum was putting you basically into exactly the wrong stocks for that stage of the market cycle, and, you know, it got creamed in January. However, since January, what you found are two very interesting things. One is that momentum has actually made a comeback globally, and second of all, momentum as a style has worked differently in different countries. So what you found is that although it didn't do as well at the beginning of the year in America, it actually did fantastically well in Australia. And the reason why you will get that sort of dispersion is because when volatility starts to rise in markets, not only do you get slower global growth, but you get more desynchronized global growth. So each of the individual cycles in the countries is starting to do its own thing, in which case what you'll find is that country-specific factors and index composition will matter a lot more than what you get from a global signal. So I think momentum is still the way to invest. The yield curve in America is still inverted. The positioning is still picking defensives, and I think it was just a little bit late to the party, and now it's starting to get up and running. The polar opposite style is, of course, value, because, you know, value is buying the stuff which is cheap and selling the stuff which is expensive, which is almost the opposite of picking yesterday's winners over losers. Now, value hasn't worked for basically 2 and a bit years, and this is really the case across all measures of value, and it's led to a lot of people to wonder why. The starting principles that we have for value investing is that you're really relying on earnings and dividends and book values to be able to anchor your asset prices and your valuations. If you call that causation and transmission into question, then value won't work. So when you're in a deleveraging environment in an asset and credit-driven economy like Australia, what you'll find is that asset prices, stocks or housing might fall, and then what you'll find is that that has a negative wealth or credit effect, which ends up undermining earnings. So if you're trying to say, look, earnings say this and valuation relative to that earnings is saying cheap, well, actually you could end up in a value trap because falling asset prices are actually driving earnings lower, and it's a bit of a circular reference. We haven't been in a deleveraging cycle globally for a while because clearly, you know, debt to GDP is still rising. But what has happened, though, is people have front-run that and said, look, we're very, very concerned about asset valuations. Looking across credit and equities and property, basically we're thinking that over the next 2 to 3 years, these things are priced for lower returns than cash in an environment where the Fed was raising rates. So the risk of an asset price bubble or two bursting was actually quite high. And so what you found is that people were very skeptical that the value that appeared within certain segments of the equity market was really value. Another way of saying the same thing is that you might have quality stocks trading on a PE which is 5 standard deviations above the norm relative to cheap cyclicals. But you know what? You'll find exactly the same disconnect happening between bonds and equities, or bonds and credit, or bonds and property within the broader asset allocation space. So therefore, you know, what is normal? Maybe plus 5 standard deviations is actually normal. So this is the thing that really has got us thinking about value investing. The last few years, global growth has actually been very good, but what people have been worried about is the fact that asset pricing has gotten so extended now that actually we have to factor in some deleveraging risk over the horizon, and if we did that, it actually becomes very hard to trust certain stocks that look cheap right now, whether you're talking financials or domestic cyclicals. So in terms of how I would position when it comes to style, I think right now if you have some good mixture of momentum and quality, that's going to serve you pretty well. Value and small caps are on the nose, and they have been so for quite some time, and it's very unusual to see them underperform as styles for such a long period of time, but that's because we've effectively tried to, the central banks of the world have tried to write puts at extremely elevated valuations that people don't trust. So I think that inflection point will come towards value and away from momentum and quality probably later in the year, but I don't think we're there yet. And what it will rely upon are basically a lot more country-specific factors. Volatility rises, global growth becomes desynchronized, and in that environment, what you'll find is that Australia-specific factors will matter a lot more. And one of the Australian specific factors which will matter a lot is, of course, the Australian election, because should the polls prove to be correct and the ALP does in fact win, what we know is that the ALP has a penchant for fiscal stimulus, and by the end of the year you'll be looking at fiscal stimulus plus RBA rate cuts, curve steepening. It all starts to actually look a little bit better, or at least less negative than what it does today, and that might actually prove to be a sufficient floor on value investing, particularly in banks and domestic cyclicals. That's the longer term roadmap. I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah. So in terms of the, you spoke about being a desynchronized global growth. Which are the countries that you sort of see, I guess, leading that down? We've certainly seen, I guess, Europe weaken quite sharply. Australia's got a lot of mixed messages. I guess the RBA talking up job strength, but other measures starting to fold. Where do you see which are the first canaries, I guess, in that coal mine?
Yeah, so Europe is the biggest worry, because it's a little bit like when we had the Greek crisis. The Greek crisis in itself seemed fairly innocuous, but the fact that central bankers couldn't close the matter out led it to become a much bigger issue and much more systemic. So the problem for me with Europe is that not only is it not really growing, the leading indicators suggest that it will not grow for quite a bit longer. In that environment, you're going to get disinflation. In that environment, a lot of the risks that the one-size-fits-all solution, which is the monetary union, will stop working. And then you're going to start to see people's assessment of credit risk, particularly for the periphery, Italy, Greece, Portugal, those sorts of countries, rise. So the onus is really there on policymakers to try to do something to repair the plumbing so that fiscal stimulus is actually possible. We still seem to be quite a way away from that, so Europe still worries me. Now, Europe has really, really non-linear effects on bond pricing, because if you're an investment-grade manager and suddenly you find that Italian government bonds or Spanish government bonds have fallen below investment grade, then suddenly you have no other option than to spread your existing money across the remaining universe of investment-grade bonds, which will, of course, include US Treasuries, Australian government bonds, JGBs, and bunds. And so what you find is that sovereign debt risk, if not contained, can actually cause bond yields in all of those other countries to fall meaningfully below what people would consider fair value. And that would be consistent with all the bond yield movements that we're seeing. So Europe, I think, is really, really important and is very, very nonlinear. I think that, you know, Australia has got obvious issues when it comes to our housing and retail cycles. And basically, it's not just the housing and retail cycles which are waning. You know, that's been a story now for quite some time. The real issue is that the last few years we've had a bulk of public infrastructure spending which has been growing and helping to offset that downturn that we would see in housing and retail sectors. Call that job creation, call that just GDP, it doesn't really matter. But then in the last year or so, what you've seen is that infrastructure spending has peaked at a very, very high level, and because it hasn't been contributing to growth anymore mechanically, all of those headwinds that we're seeing with housing and retail start to dominate. Hence, the overall GDP growth picture goes a little bit softer, or even slightly negative, depending how you want to measure it. So, Australia is also standing out there as being a bit of a troubled state. US is in between, as in. US doesn't look like it's going to experience recession anytime soon, but it's definitely experiencing tighter financial conditions and slower growth. What people are concerned about at the moment is obviously in the bond pricing, it's Europe, but also within the US, they have their own issues when it comes to housing. Housing is not collapsing, but it's not going great either. And as I said at the outset, if you are of the view that in any of these big credit-driven economies, that asset prices drive credit creation, which in turn drives GDP growth, then you have to be worried about what could happen with equities or what could happen with house prices from here on a 2 to 3 year horizon. So I totally sympathize with everybody who is bullish about US growth for now. I can see that US is still going to go okay in the short term, but there's no discounting some of those medium term risks that people are worried about. The other side of the US is that what they've had in the last few years is very, very strong fiscal stimulus. In the year ahead, we're going to get less fiscal stimulus. You throw on top of that a little bit of volatility due to trade protectionism, which seems to be a little bit wonkish at the moment for the US, and that's a recipe for materially slower growth. So whereas we've been looking at 3% plus growth in the last year or so, maybe that number goes to somewhere between 1% to 2%. So US is in between and slowing. I think the bright spot's actually China. Growth is very, very hard to measure because the official measures are quite smooth, and the deflators that they use aren't quite right for in terms of weighting and the time of the cycle. But nevertheless, whatever you think is happening to Chinese growth, it will get better. So Chinese growth on our best estimates isn't looking very good at the moment because you have exports growth negative as you smooth out the year to January, February, Chinese New Year. Electricity output, power output, those sorts of indicators haven't been looking great. But what you do see with China is this. The biggest constraint with China in the last few years has been capital outflow. Because in a fixed exchange rate system like China, when the PBOC sees capital outflow, it really only has one of two options. It can let the exchange rate, the price of money, drop, or it can let the quantity of money drop instead. So if foreigners choose not to hold RMB-denominated deposits, what will happen is that the PBOC is on the other end of that trade. They will simply extinguish those deposits and the associated reserves from existence and leave the price of money, the exchange rate, unchanged. What that does is it causes a massive liquidity and credit drain for that system. So while on the one hand, authorities might be trying to inject money into the system through fiscal stimulus and reserve requirement ratio cuts and the like, on the other hand, they're actually deleting that money from the system, and the whole system is actually going nowhere. And that has been the major constraint for China for a while. And in fact, up until very recently, whenever the authorities have decided to announce some sort of easing measure, investors have looked through the easing and said, you know what, there's some sort of bad news which is driving that, we'll just sell that. But what you found at the back end of last year is that, well, the capital flight constraint, for one reason or another, became less severe. And so that left Chinese authorities free to actually stimulate. They were running a fiscal stimulus program which was very delayed, and now we're actually going to see the benefits of that. So I think China will return to reasonable growth, not necessarily, you know, your plus 6 to 7% GDP growth numbers, but better than what we've been seeing recently. So I think that's really where the fragmentation is going to occur. Developed market is definitely going lower in terms of where the growth numbers are going. Europe is potential at recession risk, but emerging markets, I think, are going to look a little bit healthier.
And within China, there's obviously a they've got the debt is in, sorry the growth is increasingly being debt driven within China, and the housing, I guess, is at close to record level, if it's not at record levels of building, I guess. Is this is that where you think the growth will continue to occur, or are you expecting growth in the broader economy in China?
Look, as much as authorities say that they would like to generate much more consumption-driven growth, much more balanced away from fixed asset investment, I think the way that they use stimulus is really trying to cut off some of that fat-tail deleveraging risk that you are seeing in private sector credit or housing and those sorts of sectors. So, even though they say that they want to rebalance away from the very heavy industrial sectors and construction, at the end of the day, I don't think they really have any better other options to grow because the investment share of GDP is very, very high. And if you're looking for alternative growth drives to get GDP to grow without investment, well, that's going to be really, really difficult. So it all looks really unsustainable, and it looks a little bit ugly. It's not what authorities or investors actually would like to see. However, it is still the delta which matters. So if you're seeing growth from a much lower base, I think investors will take that. The real issue, I guess, from a sustainability point of view, A, you've got deteriorating demographics, which, okay, is not so great for the housing cycle. But the second thing that we have to contend with is, you know, how much dollar-denominated debt is actually in the system? It's all fine and good if you're Japan and all your debts are basically denominated in the very currency that you can print. And the evidence that that is a somewhat sustainable outcome is the fact that you've got government debt to GDP in Japan at enormous levels, but yet nobody seems to really bat an eyelid about that. Is it possible for China to do the same thing? And this is where, you know, people are quite skeptical, and we are quite skeptical as well, because we just simply don't know how much dollar-denominated debt there is in the system. Let alone talking about shadow banking, liquidity drains, RMB overvaluation, and all of that. So I don't think any of those long-term issues have really gone away. It's just a question of whether there's actually something tactical that we can trade in this resources China bounce for the moment.
Right. I guess, and switching to Australia, you run a number of sort of proprietary indicators. Just wanted to see what, and in particular, sort of some of the ones that caught my eye recently were these sort of jobs and consumption ones. Do you want to just, I guess, touch on what goes into those proprietary indicators and what they're showing at the moment?
Yeah, so we've had a long and checkered past of trying to forecast Aussie GDP growth using financial conditions. So the craze globally has really been to try to not forecast, but at least just nowcast. Tell me what's happening today. And what we found is that our best attempt to actually do that, using the data that comes available every month, retail sales, NAB business confidence, consumer confidence, building approvals, all of those sorts of indicators, when you put them together, it actually maps quite neatly to domestic demand growth in Australia when you strip out the mining sector. Stripping out the mining sector is not a data mining exercise. What it reflects is the fact that the mining capex cycle is incredibly lumpy and at one point was heavily, heavily driven by foreign direct investment, which our domestic indicators will not be able to capture. So what we can say is something about the non-mining cycle, and then what we hope to say is, okay, do we think based on the strength of commodity prices in the emerging markets that there will be a sufficient offset? What we're seeing right now with our activity tracker for domestic demand is that it's not looking very healthy. You have real retail sales growth, which is barely tracking in line with population growth. You have slowing overall system credit growth. You have housing sentiment, which is still very, very low, even after a recent recovery. Business confidence has fallen, as it usually does in the lead up to an election. Building approvals are falling and tracking quite far below the level of actual dwelling completions. And the worst thing is that infrastructure spending, as in future project commencements, are actually tracking below current activity, precisely because we've reached a very high level and it's very, very hard to grow from a very high base. So you put that all together, it is a very, very broadly based slowdown that we're seeing in Australia on the domestic demand front. Now, mining capex, I think, might be able to bounce a little bit from its lows. It's already shrunk a lot more than what policymakers would have believed and suggested. So commodity prices are up, emerging markets are doing a little bit better. Okay, fine. Mining capex might do a little bit better. But whether it will provide that meaningful offset for the rest of the cycle by itself, I don't think so. So what this means is that we need to see more help from outside the system. We need to see either fiscal help or terms of trade uplift or something like that, preferably some combination of the lot. And until we get all of that, we're going to have to see RBA rate cuts. So to my mind, it's pretty clear that domestic demand is in the gutter here in Australia. Mining capex might be able to help a little bit, but not enough. And in terms of how we see jobs, jobs are a lagging indicator on domestic demand. Now, what we find when we try to forecast jobs growth is that if we combine our assessment as to where domestic demand is currently tracking, and if we use also some of the other leading indicators that people love, like ANZ job ads or NAB survey employment or SEEK job ads or whatever you fancy, putting those all together actually gives you a very, very reliable picture as to what's going to happen with the employment outlook. And it's not pointing to outright contraction in employment, but it's certainly pointing to much slower jobs growth than we're used to. And I think a lot of the forecasts which are coming out, particularly from the more bearish commentators, are right, that we probably will see jobs growth slow below the rate of population growth, if not the rate of labour force growth. So I do think we're going to see a higher unemployment rate from here.
Yeah, and I'm guessing a lot of that is centred around the construction industry, which is sort of relatively, it's generally thought of as having quite a high multiplier effect. So a job in construction, gets you some lawyers here and there and conveyances and all the different people flowing down the line.
Yeah, Commodore Ute.
So in terms of the slowdown, I guess, have you factored that sort of that in? And is that the, is that where we're seeing that the effect will be greater if you lose 100,000 jobs, say, from construction than if you lost 100,000 jobs from mining? Well, maybe that's too big of the numbers, but 30,000 jobs from construction versus 30,000 jobs from mining?
Yeah. So I totally agree with you. the experience of from 2012 to 2015 shows you that you can have a major bust in WA and Queensland driven by mining capex, and you don't necessarily see major job losses. So as it turned out, policymakers were more right than wrong in pointing out that at the time there's a lot of offshoring of activity, a lot of offshore labour as opposed to domestic labour, which was used to build this stuff. And so therefore, we didn't get the employment boom, we didn't necessarily get the employment bust. I agree with you. The housing cycle has much bigger multiplier effects because it touches so many other sectors. The big risk in some of the... So the nowcast is only telling me what's actually happening today. So it's a very, very short-term view as to what those multiplier effects look like. But long-term, I'm very, very concerned about some of the negative multiplier effects that could come through. So the biggest one is via consumption, which is 60% of GDP. And so house prices falling, historically, every 1% drop in house prices is meant to be like a 0.1% decline in consumption via wealth effect. Now, there's a lot of debate happening at the moment between, or particularly driven by the central bank, about the size of wealth effects, and there's almost a trivialization of the wealth effect because they're saying it might affect motor vehicle sales and a few other categories of spending, but not the whole lot. The issue for me is that what's happening with housing is not just a wealth and sentiment effect. There is an outright cash flow effect. And Lucy Ellis actually alluded to this in her speech today, because you don't need to see falling house prices to see a fall in housing turnover. And if you get a fall in housing turnover and people aren't moving homes as quickly, well, they're not spending as much on white goods. On top of that, what you find is that because people at the moment are aggressively paying down their debt for one reason or another, that means that reduced housing turnover, falling house prices, greater repayment of debt, there is massive injection into the home equity base from here as opposed to a home equity withdrawal. That is a very, very big negative cash flow effect that the saving rate actually can't fully capture. So the risk here is that consumption actually remains weaker for longer, and if it does, then you're not only talking about domestic demand growth being somewhere between 0 and 1%, you could actually see overall GDP growth do the same thing. So I think that the numbers that we're looking at right now with the nowcasts are only partially factoring in some of those tail risks as you get contagion from housing to other sectors. What gives us some degree of confidence that the tail risk will be limited is if you get adequate policy response and easing response from both the RBA and the government. What worries us is that in as much as we'd like to see that sort of response, it's not forthcoming yet.
And I guess on that, Damien, just the so job stats are sort of, are we about 6 months in terms of a trailing indicator on the economy?
Yes,
interest rate cut takes what, at least 6 months to get to filter through, maybe up to 12 or 18 months. Is that the rough rules of thumb?
I think rate cuts are interesting because the leads and lags are quite variable through time. So, the rate cuts seem to actually have a fairly they had a short term effect on GDP growth in the GFC, against the massive headwinds that were happening globally. But then it had a delayed effect as we kept monetary policy looser for longer, and then we had an influx of foreign buying into the property market, and then low rates fueled the housing investor cycle. So there was a short term effect. There was a long term effect. My concern at the moment with transmission is that funding costs, or so-called funding costs, I call them, for the banks, are still elevated. And what this means is that if the marginal cost of funds for the banks is elevated, that means that the average or the total cost of funds will be gradually rising. Now, if you strip out all of that stuff which is happening in the interbank market, the other bottom line is this. Banks have a lot of their deposits. Their deposit liabilities is in the form of fixed rate deposits, which either offer no interest or very little interest. So when you cut rates, what you find is that the net interest margin for the banks starts to shrink. The relative cost of those no or low interest rate deposits starts to rise. This is a big issue because it means that if the banks were to fully pass on rate cuts from here, with the interbank stress, with the composition of their loan books, well, actually, they're going to experience quite a large hit to profit margins. So the net of that is that they will not pass on a lot of the rate cuts. In fact, the estimates that we've managed to put together, both from a macro perspective and also from the bottom-up perspective, is that you should expect less than 40% of every 25 basis point rate cut from here to be passed on, which is staggering. Now, people said that these pass-through issues would never materialise during the Hayne Royal Commission, and exactly the opposite happened. The banks and the smaller lenders did put through rate out-of-cycle rate hikes despite the political pressure on them not to do so. So I think the funding pressures and the funding models are still very much valid considerations to assess the effectiveness of monetary policy. So what will monetary policy do from here if it's not actually helping the end borrower that much? Well, it will still be helping the end borrower to some degree. There will still be some pass-through. It may actually help to mitigate the extent of payment shocks which are coming through as interest-only loans reset to principal and interest. And we know that we're hitting a peak in that reset pipeline this year. It may help to take the sting out of the Aussie dollar, but for what happens with US interest rates and commodity prices. But, you know, it really is a BB gun facing up against a tank here. And so what you really need is not just the positive signalling and the jawboning and the action from the RBA. You really need to see the federal government come to the party as well. But that could take a while. Because we know that if and when you get a change in government in Australia, what you'll see is that, you know, the copper wiring, the phone lines, all of that will be ripped out. It's very dysfunctional. People will take their time to get their offices and the infrastructure of their offices up and running even before they can actually consider policy. And then, you know, if you did actually see an ALP victory, you know, what sort of other agendas will need to be dealt with first before the actual state of the economy? So, to my mind, stimulus will come, and we should start to bank on that at some point in time as the valuations become attractive to position for that. However, you know, it really is a fourth quarter event. And between now and the fourth quarter is a long, long time to be sitting there hoping that fiscal policy makers will stimulate and that the RBA will stimulate to support the domestic end of our equity market.
And do you think the RBA has got scope for Australian quantitative easing? Is that or do you think that's they'll take a while before they, you know, it's going to take them 6 months or 12 months of pain before they decide to bite the bullet on it? Cutting rates so quickly, so much already.
Yeah. So the quantitative easing question is very interesting. So a lot of people have talked about it, and so most people think that if you did US-style quantitative easing, it wouldn't be effective for two reasons. One is that we don't really have a lot of government bonds to buy off the banks. What sort of impact are you having with your asset purchase program from the very outset? But the second thing is, and most importantly, most of the mortgages that we have in Australia are tied to the short end rather than the long end. So, you know, lowering long rates, unless you're going to have wholesale maturity transformation of the Aussie loan book, well, you know, that's really not going to be that effective. So what people do talk about are things like TLTRO, targeted long-term repo operations in Australia, much like what the Europeans have done, where basically it's a funding for lending or lending for funding scheme, where the banks, if they're struggling to get adequate reserves to satisfy their regulatory requirements, will lend first, internally securitize that, pass all that off to the RBA in exchange for reserves, and that's supposed to do the job. I like the acronym TLTRO because it doesn't just stand for targeted long-term repo operation, it also stands for too late to rescue others. It doesn't actually relax the binding constraint on bank lending. The availability of reserves does not constrain bank lending in a country like Australia. Loans create deposits, reserves are sought out as an afterthought and are always supplied by the central bank if it is actually serious about controlling the cash rate. That's not modern monetary theory, that's just what's on the RBA website. So if that's the case, then even TLTRO doesn't do much. So, okay, rate cuts might not do much in small measures. TLTRO might not do that much. Where is the bang for buck in a quantitative easing program? The biggest bang for buck, I think, is if you regress a little bit with the way the system is designed. So if you are able to go back to the bad old days where we targeted our FX rate, then what you actually do is you would introduce greater volatility to the cash rate because you would basically give up control of that. You'd be injecting copious amounts of reserves into the system in order to bring the Aussie dollar down. Interest rates would probably fall down to zero anyway. But at least you would actually be achieving something. You'd be managing your currency. and who knows from there? Once you start to do that, you start to have an economy which looks a lot more like China, where if you're not dealing with capital outflow, then what you're actually starting to see then is you've got excess reserves in the system. The whole funding model actually starts to change, where you start to ration reserves as a way of controlling lending rather than changing the cash rate, because the cash rate's now down at zero. And if you did that, you might actually be quite effective. Now, that would require the RBA to basically go back to pre-deregulation and pre-float. And I don't think anybody wants to go back to that era. But, you know, they're the sorts of things that are necessary if you really want to entertain quantitative easing.
Mm. But I guess in terms of the timeframes you're talking about, from our perspective, we've sort of been looking at the RBA saying, why haven't they cut yet? Why haven't they cut yet? And I think you've probably sort of been on a similar boat that they should be looking to cut earlier. We've sort of seen this game play out in numerous countries right around the world, and the whole secular stagnation and lack of demand. Yet the RBA sort of seems to be running quite a traditional model to date, and so it seems hard to see that the RBA would change quickly to a more advanced version.
Yeah, so I think what's happening with the RBA is really two extreme opposite ways of interpreting the phrase that rate cuts are ineffective or that they lack utility. So what you saw in 2016 was kind of interesting, because at the end of 2016, everybody kind of, the conventional economists said that we had emerged from a phase of secular stagnation to a more normal growth environment, and therefore rates could normalize across the board. And, you know, we saw bond yields rise very sharply. Some people call that the volcano. And interest people in Australia started to talk about outright rate hikes. But what we know, of course, is that with hindsight, a lot of that was driven by two factors. One was the valuation starting point when it came to bonds, and the second thing was what policymakers did, i.e. fiscal policymakers. Because in 2016, what happened was we had the BOJ entertain negative rates. You saw a perverse market reaction to that. The ECB entertained negative rates. We saw a perverse market reaction to that. Then in June 2016, we saw the BOJ talk up the myth of helicopter money, and then basically BOJ Governor Kuroda had to concede that there's no such thing, there's no such possibility, because if we trace through the plumbing of the system, again, this is not an MMT thing, this is just what's on the RBA website, what you find is that helicopter money is fiscal stimulus. It's one and the same. It's exactly the same operation from a plumbing double entry accounting perspective. So that meant, okay, well, we're looking for fiscal stimulus as opposed to monetary stimulus, and monetary policymakers weren't able to deliver it. And then Trump came along and he said that he was able to deliver it. And then you had a little bit happening in China, and suddenly it looked like coordinated global fiscal stimulus, coordinated global growth. But people mistook that for an emergence out of secular stagnation. And the illusion disappeared very quickly in the last few years, because the nature of fiscal stimulus is this. If I go from a budget balance position to running 2% of GDP deficits in perpetuity, I get a 2% kick to GDP growth in the first year, but I get no increment to GDP growth after that. So unless you have it in mind to go from 0 to 2% deficit to 2 to 4 to 4 to 6 to 6 to 8, ever-expanding deficits, geometric increases in the rate of growth in debt for the government, you're not actually going to get a consistent stimulatory impulse from fiscal policymakers. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Election cycles are not long enough to see that sustained fiscal stimulus, and, you know, there's all sorts of ideological reasons why people won't do that either. So we're left with a fiscal fade. We're left with a private sector which is largely over-indebted in most countries in the world, perhaps even more over-indebted now that some of the housing markets have run. And people are wondering, what do you do next? And we're all hoping for the same sugar hit for more fiscal stimulus. But at least in Australia, we can see that, well, it's going to be some time away. So I think this is a useful background to understand where the RBA is at, because the RBA would have very much liked to believe that narrative that we had emerged from secular stagnation and that everything was hunky-dory, that growth in national income was just as good as growth in national output. One would lead to the other, and everything would be fine. As it turns out, we've realized how exposed we are to the global cycle, whether it's through Chinese buying of Australian property or Chinese buying of commodities. It hasn't really mattered. Either way, the net balance of forces has not been favorable in the absence of a fiscal stimulus from state governments or federal government. So this means that the RBA is left as the responsible adult in charge until fiscal policymakers do their thing, and it really has to push on a string. It's been saying for quite some time, fiscal stimulus is the right way out, not monetary stimulus, because monetary policy lacks utility. We had admissions from RBA officials in the last easing cycle, or last two rate cuts, I should say, that they were disappointed, actually, with how little the economy and housing responded to rate cuts. So we're having a very clear view expressed that monetary policy is definitely not the way to go, but it's the only way that we have to go right now. So now bond market investors have to go completely the other way, that it was the case that rate cuts are ineffective, fiscal policymakers would exercise their put, and that would be reflationary, support rate hike pricing, and support higher bond yields. Now the narrative is, oh no, rate cuts aren't effective, there is no fiscal stimulus response, maybe we have to cut rates all the way. And the RBA doesn't want to do that because A, it is concerned about effectiveness, B, it has this macroprudential mandate still in the back of its mind about what that might do to housing. I don't know why, but it has that view. But most importantly, what you'll find is that as rate cuts ensue and rates go towards zero and we're getting closer to the point of quantitative easing, we're also getting closer to the point that central bank policy in Australia becomes irrelevant. So it doesn't surprise me then that we start to see central bankers decide to participate in broader discussions like climate change and the like, because the debate is no longer about the effectiveness of this blunt tool. The debate is about what central bankers and macroeconomists have to add to the asset and the resource allocation decisions for the broader country. So I think that there is that stubbornness. We can kind of explain it in terms of the political relevance of the RBA as an organisation, but really it is about waiting for fiscal stimulus to appear.
Yeah. And look, just because I guess in the interest of time, I just might wrap up on that, and I just wanted to jump quickly on a few questions sort of more about the sort of quant versus fundamental. But just the last one on the Aussie interest rates. So you've obviously been long bonds, and we're sort of, I think, on the, well, we've been on the same page with you there, and that's been quite a nice trade over the last little bit. What are your sort of lines in the sand, say, on the 10-year bond rate, where you're thinking, okay, well, now's the time to start taking some profits, or from I guess there's a shorter term tactical issue, but there's a sort of a longer term, I guess, the play of the cycle. What are your?
Yeah. So well, there's three things that we look at, and for me to change the view about bonds really only requires two of those three things to change. So we're looking at whether bonds are overbought or oversold on some sort of short term sentiment indicator. We're looking at the outright valuation of Aussie government bonds on some sort of neutral rate framework, and I'm also looking at what's happening with global bond pricing. So what we find at the moment is that bonds in Australia are actually not expensive, despite the enormous rally that they've had, but they are overbought. They have run too far too quickly. So from this sort of starting point, what you should expect from here is that the entire curve should go down, as in bonds across the curve can rally, but what I think will happen is that the overbought signal will kick in and that you'll actually start to see curve steepening as bonds rally. So it's a bull steepening of the yield curve. Where I could change that view is if, you know, a lot of the neutral rate models that we run are based on historical nominal GDP growth as well as what I call the break-even cost of capital for overgeared households. And the break-even cost of capital for overgeared households tends to fall the more impaired your monetary transmission mechanism is, i.e. the lower the rate of pass-through of RBA rate cuts to end borrowers. Now, I think there is definitely a case that pass-through is impaired, and there is definitely the case that pass-through is impaired to the point that the neutral rate estimate has to fall to between 1% to 1.5% in Australia. So that's kind of where I'm looking for the 10-year. However, if you get overbought conditions staying there for longer, and suddenly you see so-called term risk premium in global bonds, i.e. the gap between bond yields and what people actually think terminal rates will be, if that spread were to go negative, then I think that you'd actually have to start thinking about taking money off the table on the bond trade. But I do think that Aussie bonds, the fair valuation is really in the low ones here.
Excellent. Thanks for that. So just to, I guess, change tack just quite quickly for a minute, because aware we've taken up a lot of your time. So you run a lot of quant models. I guess we're probably relatively similar in terms of, you know, running a lot of quant models and then running fundamental processes to check that and to sort of to to bounce off and test the validity. I guess in terms of your head, how much weight do you put on the what the quant's telling you versus the fundamental? Sort of, is it a 50-50, or are you taking more to the quant or more to the fundamental as you're doing your analysis?
Through the cycle, I tend to be a bit more 50-50, but part of the reason why I think people go 50-50 is because they're worried that the quant signals can lie to you from time to time, and that's a valid concern. And part of the reason why quant models can lie to you is, I mean, people have told me in the past, you'll never see a bad backtest. Of course not, because a backtest is usually overfitted, over-engineered, and over a sample which actually suits the story of whoever's actually presenting it.
Absolutely. And if I get a bad one, I just keep running more until I get a good one.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. So in recent years, what I've done is I've increased my weight on quant, but that's because I've developed a framework which I think is actually robust through the cycles. So what I mean by that is that, as I said before, I come from the perspective that asset allocation signals, market, will drive economy, which will drive policy. So if you are able to adequately model what's going to happen for future returns for all the different asset classes, you don't have to model it on a one-year horizon. You can model it on a 5 to 10-year horizon, maybe even a 20-year horizon. It doesn't really matter. You can actually use those signals to basically get a better understanding as to where the balance of growth risks lie on a 3 to 5 year horizon, and you can actually use that to time your styles. And what you find is that there's actually tremendous diversification benefit between combining asset allocation trades and style trades, i.e. value, quality, momentum, or carry, liquidity, all of those sorts of alternative risk premium. And what you find, I think, is that the backtest history is actually very rich. So you can do asset allocation work for the US going all the way back to the 1900s. You can do factor backtesting going all the way back to 1930. And so that's a lot of cycles with which to test. Now, no two cycles are ever going to be the same, but what you find is that a robust framework that's backtested over a very, very long period of time is actually able to improve your information and Sharpe ratios, almost double them, actually. So what I will go away and do is I'll run these signals. And in picking stocks, what I'll do is I'll say, right, the stocks have got certain exposures to underlying asset classes, whether it's commodities or housing or whatnot. Then I want to look at what the factor style characteristics are of those stocks. Are they momentum stocks, quality stocks, value stocks, growth stocks? And then what I want to do is I want to get my highest conviction longs and shorts by looking at the overlap between the two sets of signals, because effectively what I'm doing is getting the best of both alpha and beta. And then finally what I want to do is I want to overlay the fundamental outlook over that. So that's why I'm shifting a little bit more towards the quant end of things, but it's because there's a robust platform for backtesting which has gone many, many cycles that at least I've convinced myself is not over-engineered and overfitted, but the fundamentals still matter. And the fundamentals are this. As we said at the outset, momentum works when you have confidence that positioning will be repeated and vindicated in the period ahead based on a leading indicator. Value works in the absence of deleveraging pressure. Quality works when you're contrarian and bearish about the cycle. Growth works when you're contrarian and bullish about the cycle. On a long enough horizon, if it's always the same uncertain future that I'm buying, it's always just a question of how much I'm paying for that uncertain future. So valuation should be the single most important driver of future returns on any asset class. I think those sorts of founding principles, basic principles, are well grounded in theory and should actually work themselves out through time. And in fact, they have done so. So recently, in the last 2 years, with US growth being actually pretty good, people talking about synchronized global growth, you should have seen value come back from a fundamental perspective, but it didn't. It didn't because asset valuations were through the moon across a broad range of asset classes, and value investors were worried about that. Momentum was choppy because sometimes momentum was pro-cyclical positions, sometimes it was defensively positioned. But what you could have bet your bottom dollar on was that quality would have actually risen to the fore because you had a contrarian bearish setup because of those longer-term deleveraging risks embedded in elevated multiples and Fed tightening and protectionism thrown on top. So that's what we've kind of gone with. It's very much been about quality for the last 2 years. This time around, now we're going for momentum. And the reason why we're going for momentum is because position is defensive. Leading indicators are looking not so healthy for the global cycle. But momentum should do better than quality, and it should do better than low beta to pick defensive exposures. Because at some point, if you really are going to see risk move from the periphery of the world, i.e. China and Turkey and all those sorts of economies, to the core of the world, i.e. Europe and US, on a 3 to 5 year horizon, then you must be thinking about the safety of your deposits in the banking system in the core. And we know that FDIC insurance, deposit insurance more generally, is very limited. So if you're a large-scale investor, you cannot afford to treat cash as a safe haven. Instead, you have to start looking at alternatives such as bonds, repos, even commodities. I think that only momentum is able to tell you how that search for safety is evolving. Standard quality metrics will always lean against resources stocks. Low beta will always lean against resources stocks. But actually, they may be a defensive asset class. And what you're finding right now is that the historically strong correlation between commodity prices and world industrial production growth has completely broken down. In fact, it's broken down for the last few years. And that is a testament to the fact that commodities actually have safe haven value. So what you're finding is that gold and oil, they're holding up pretty okay, considering that you have bouts of US dollar strength. The rest of the spectrum, depending on supply side issues, are also holding up, but you would be a little bit more worried if, in fact, we go into a global slowdown environment. So that's broadly how we're kind of looking at the world at the moment, an ongoing search for safety, which is iterative, and I don't want to presume to know all the answers. I want to learn from what the market is saying as well. But we do have the signals aligned, where asset allocation signals are saying emerging markets overdeveloped, and our style signals are saying long momentum over value.
Yeah, no problems. Okay, thanks, Damien. We might just turn the attention from that terrific recap from overseas to local soils just to finish up. I'll reference a paper that you put out almost exactly 2 months ago, just remarking on Sydney house prices, Australia's favourite bubble that's sort of obviously falling down in front of our very eyes. You had a couple of positives sort of against a predicted fall of 9%. There were some tentative signs that Chinese demand was bottoming out and also that supply was falling. Now, obviously, that was 2 months ago and a lot's happened in the past 2 months, including a state election in New South Wales. So I was just wondering if you had any updates on the ideas of where house prices are going now in 2019.
Yeah, yeah. So I still think that house prices are going to fall. In our forecast, we're not putting in tremendously bearish forecasts on the assumption that a feedback loop between housing and rising unemployment is somehow avoided by policymakers. So that's a risk factor that's always going to be out there, but we're not going to budget for that. Effectively we're assuming that fiscal help, monetary help, ends up being on the money, which may be a flawed assumption, but it's just a starting point. So we're continuing to see supply fall, as in building approvals in trend terms are falling. Completions will have to follow through. So supply cuts in their own right, assuming that you don't get any additions from foreclosures, should actually start to stabilise the housing market. The problem is that the supply cuts which are baked in are not adequate. So right now building approvals are running at around 180,000 annualised. And a lot of people are saying that, look, approvals might stabilise at that level considering how strong population growth is. The problem is that population growth has been strong for a while and supportive of household formation rates between 160,000 to 180,000, but we went and built over 200,000 homes in the last few years. So if we can overshoot by 40,000 to 60,000 homes, we can easily undershoot by the same amount. So that's why I think that building approvals, if you are relying on a supply side response alone to bring stability back to the housing market, it won't be enough. The second thing is demand. What we've seen is that Chinese capital flows, outflows, had their seasonal spike at the end of last year, and then they've now subsided. So Chinese demand has stabilised, but at a very low level. Now, on top of that, what you've seen in New South Wales is that property transfers have significantly undershot what our models of demand based on capital flight from China would suggest. And that's no surprise. It's got to do with the tightening of lending standards that we saw at the back end of last year, which you don't seem to see in the APRA data, but we know anecdotally it kind of happened. LVR ratios were cut quite dramatically, so on and so forth. So, you could argue from here that lending standards will ease. In fact, banks are actively being encouraged to do so by certain RBA officials. But even then, the supply response and the demand-supply balance are not sufficiently supportive of house prices. So I still think that you were looking at house prices falling, maybe not as much as what they did in the last year, but still falling. And I don't see stability returning until 2020. One of the interesting things that we've also done is we've gone away and tried to understand a lot of the buyer inquiry data that GY and other vendors have actually been producing. And this is really interesting data because we actually can get quite a lot of it, and the reasonable amount of data that we have shows that it actually lags the cycle. It doesn't lead it.
Okay. Yeah, sure thing. Look, I think that's probably us out of time. And look, thanks very much for all those fantastic insights and giving us a little bit of a look behind the engine room of Credit Suisse as well, and your thinking. Have you got some anything for our listeners in by way of getting access to your information, or is there something they can follow to keep in the loop?
Yeah. So my articles are available on our platform CS Plus. If you want to subscribe to them, please organise. For that to happen with the relevant people here at CS. But otherwise, you'll probably see me or my work on the MB website or otherwise in the papers.
Okay, fantastic. Well, look, yeah, thanks very much for your time today, and we look forward to getting you onto the podcast sometime soon. Thanks, Damien.
All right. Thanks very much.
So, Damien, terrific 45-odd minutes there spent with a bloke that's certainly got his head in the markets by no stretch of the imagination, Damien. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think probably hopefully the listeners sort of hung with us for a lot of that. I think for myself that was very interesting because we run similar processes. I think we're probably more probably a little more macro-focused and individual stocks focused, and whereas he's more – sector and economy focused across some of these models, and
he's got quite a local focus as well. It sounded he's like
with the
Australian stuff that he's focusing on, probably just as part of his job more than anything. But yeah,
So for me, you know, very interesting insights. I thought some of the stuff he said quite well was that question about when to be in different types of allocations. We sort of run mainly quality and value strategies within our portfolios.
Yep.
And we tend to switch between the two, and we've sort of been pretty heavy on quality and pretty light on value for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Which has worked very well for us in terms of, you know, outperforming the market. But as he said, you know, value's had a tough time of it. So for sort of one of the key things for me is when you do go into downturns, it's usually either quality or value that will be your outperformer within that. And so, you know, his characterization of talking about when quality will outperform versus when value outperforms versus when growth outperforms, I thought was quite a good insight into that for anyone else following those types of strategies.
Yep, sure.
So, yes, that sort of puts me on the, you know, it's that question we keep going over as to when do we start dialing up the value
switching over. Okay.
His insights into the Aussie economy. I think it's very important to note that whole discussion is and what he talked about in terms of feedback loops, and that's one of the things which I think we probably differ where we differ the most. I think we've got very similar outlooks, but I think as he was saying, he's got this sort of default view of this is what the Australian economy is going to do, but you need to take into account there's feedback loops, and you will have fiscal stimulus and you will have monetary stimulus, and
the rules can change.
Yeah, exactly. And so here's what your glide path is. Yes, you're headed in for a crash, but you know the pilot's not going to.
Yeah,
just stand there, and you know, unless they're an ECB pilot, you know, they're going to try and pull up.
Yep, sure.
And so the question for me though is coming back to this unconventional monetary methods, and whether we get back to, I think the RBA has been very, very traditional in its outlook.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a real benefit is that the rest of the world's been through this, and we've seen the rest of the world go through it.
We know the levers to pull.
And we should know the levers to pull. and we should be able to see that, you know, US obviously did a lot better than countries that tried to stick with the traditional ways of thinking.
Yep.
And so Damien's obviously got a lot of his work at the RBA, and he's got a lot of faith that they will
figure it out eventually.
Figure it out.
Yep.
The question is when eventually is. And I think at the moment I'm probably more on the, I guess because they've fought cutting rates so hard for so long.
Getting to be too little too late, do you think? Or
Well, I'm just more on the. To me, that's displayed an element of intransience that will take time to flip around, and so maybe they do need to see unemployment rising, and you know that they need to see some significant some numbers that come out that significantly change the way they look at the world. And it doesn't, you know, you can't go from 0 to 100 quickly. If you're headed in, you know, if you're drifting in one direction and you want to head back the other direction, you need more signs. Whereas if they're already on the path of saying we know we're going to have to do all these unconventional monetary easing, and then they get a few more signs that's showing, yeah, now's the time to do it. Mm. It's much easier to launch in it than if you're headed in the opposite direction, and then you have to sort of change your whole narrative around and change your whole thinking around. And so that's where my concern is that 6 month lag to employment data or so, and a 6 to 12 month lag on rate cuts, and you know, you can if that's where it's being run, it might be too late.
Yeah. Okay.
So you know, but certainly his point is valid that. If you get a government in there that if you get the RBA turning around later on this year and getting quite aggressive in terms of trying to stimulate, mm-hmm. and if you get a federal government that's out there aggressively stimulating, then absolutely we'll need to change our
viewpoint and portfolios.
How we're looking at it.
Yeah, okay.
And the other one as well, sorry, there's a lot of little ones, but...
we covered a lot of ground
and
today.
One more, we did, is that whole focus on the Aussie dollar. And as I said, that to me, again, that's very near and dear to our heart, is that the Aussie dollar is your key to recovery.
Mm.
And so it's basically playing the game of, can we get the Aussie dollar down as low as we can? Obviously, there's a lot of other countries fighting to try and get their currency down as well.
Yep.
But that'll be one of the key factors going forward. And that'll tell you know, if the Aussie dollar falls faster, the recovery will be faster. The longer it stays high, and if you get stuck in this part where it's kept high by high commodity prices, but the domestic economy is crashing, which is sort of where we see ourselves at the moment, then that just means it's a longer and deeper downturn in the domestic economy before you turn around.
Okay, sure thing. Plenty to keep the eye on. All right, well, on that note...
Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers. Hello and welcome to yet another instalment of our Nucleus Wealth Insights series. Just a quick reminder that the following presentation is general information only and does not take into account your personal circumstances. Whilst Nucleus Wealth aims to present informing and sometimes entertaining content, please consult your investment professional, financial advisor, or better yet, speak to us before making any decisions based on any of the themes discussed in today's presentation.